Blog Talk Radio.
Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. My name is Paula Townsend. I'm your host, and with me are my dear friends and co-hosts, Pamela Chaddock, Chuck Thurston, and Andre Rodatis. Hi, you guys.
Hi.
Good morning.
Hey,
good morning, everyone.
It is such a beautiful day here in Colorado. Oh my gosh, the skies are blue. Beautiful Saturday morning, and we have a great show planned for you guys. An interview that, you know, the opportunity for this just came up, as often happens with the Cosmic Citizen, and we're always happy to promote wonderful events and efforts going on in the Urantia movement. And, you know, what we're interviewing today is we're interviewing Mike Butler and Carol Engel Enright, and they have created a school, the School for Statesmanship, Stewardship, and Service. And this is like right out of the Urantia book. I mean, it's statesmanship certainly isn't unique to the Urantia book, neither is stewardship or service, but it's that important that it's mentioned many, many times in the Urantia book as something that we should be doing. And so Mike and Carol have done this endeavor, and it was inspired on multiple fronts by the Urantia book. And Mike's extensive service as Chief of Public Safety, and particularly his work throughout his career as a leader in the applied juridical philosophy of restorative justice, Mike has been a leader in promoting restorative practices throughout Boulder County and the USA. He's highly sought after as a speaker. Carol Engel Enright, his partner, PhD, has been a leader in adult education and is a retired professor of fashion design and merchandising. She is the co-founder of SOS, which is the short version, and she's an ardent student of the Urantia book. So Mike and Carol, welcome to the show. We're just so happy to have you on this morning.
Good morning, Paula, Andre, Chuck, and Pamela. It's great to be here. We're excited to be with you.
Yeah. Likewise.
Good to have you.
Yeah, it
Thank
is so great to have you.
And maybe what we can say to our audience right away is that
rather than saying the mouthful of school of statesmanship, stewardship, and service, as you indicated, we're just going to refer to it as SOSAS, S-O-S-S-A-S. And anyone who wants to access our URL, it's SOSSAS.org. And maybe you want to go on right now or maybe you want to go on later. But so we'll be referring to it as SOSAS.
Okay.
Sounds good.
Well, yeah. And, you know, so what, you know, I know I might add, just disclosure, Mike and Carol study with Andre and I every Tuesday night with a study group that was founded in 1990, probably 91, and by Mo Siegel and myself. We wanted to create a study group for newer readers, and so we decided that the best way to do that was to just stick with the Jesus Papers, because what we found over the years was that we worked so hard to introduce somebody to your Rancher book, and then they would come to a study group, and we'd be in the middle of a deep intellectual discussion on energy, mind, and matter, and they'd go glassy-eyed, and we'd never see them again. So we said, we can't let these, it's too hard to get them interested, you know, and then only to come to a study group and lose them. So we decided we'd create a study group that was friendly to new readers, that anybody, no matter, that the story is familiar enough, Jesus, thankfully, is familiar enough that anybody can jump into that story almost anywhere you are in your study and just get right into it. And that's been true. We have found that that's true. And so we've just stuck with that format these many years. And we have rotating leaders. And Mike and Carol are rotating leaders for that study group. And it's just so wonderful to have you both involved. So I know that the Arantia book was the inspiration for your school, but can you tell us about that and what, you know, how that evolved? And
sure. And
you
again,
can also, if you like, tell us about yourself and how you've, you know, found the Arantia book and a little bit about yourself too.
Okay, I'll start, and Carol will definitely be contributing mightily to this program. But the first thing I want to say, too, the second thing I guess I want to say is that I would like for our conversation that we're going to have to serve as an invitation to anybody. And when I do talk and do presentations, I always start off by saying, while this is a presentation, please also see it in the context as an invitation to become involved and to have your voice heard and your, because we know your voice counts, your thoughts matter, your humanness is valued. And that's a big part of who we are and the work that we do and a big basis for SOSAS. And so please consider this an invitation. We'll probably end up giving you contact information. We will end up giving you opportunities to take some of the classes that SOSAS is offering in terms of school, you know, the statesmanship, stewardship, and service models that we discuss very in-depthly. But anyway, just please consider this an offering for anybody. If you're interested at all, we would love to hear from you in any way, shape, or form. And so with that, I'll just say, you know, I discovered the Arantia book when I was 25 years old, 45 plus years ago. And I've been reading it for 45 years. And the person who introduced me to the book when I worked at the Boulder Police Department, and I was in the role of a detective. And the other person who worked there, who I got to become best friends with and had dinner with him last night and his wife, Carol, was Terry Kruger. And Terry and I got to be really best friends and spent quite a bit of time, probably more time than we should have spent while we were at the Boulder Police Department discussing the many questions I had, because Terry was already an experienced reader of the Arantia Papers. Mm. But so anyway, my desire to go to work went up about a billion-fold because Terry was waiting for me to answer my questions. And so anyway, that was how I discovered it. But maybe the more important part for me is the application. I also see the Urantia Papers as a giant, magnificent, profound invitation to each and every one of us to make our corner of the world, however small or big that might be,
mm-hmm.
better.
Mm-hmm.
And that, and that, you know, these papers are all about service.
Mm-hmm.
That is the fruit of you know, our spirituality and our religion, and a sense that how can we help people discover their own voices? How can we help people take their profound gifts they have and utilize them for the good of the whole? And so that's what we ended up, that's what I ended up doing in terms of the work that I did over the years that I was in the public safety profession. And by the way, when people say chief of public safety, some people don't know necessarily what that means. I oversaw police and fire and a few other social services related to a few of the social issues, including addiction and mental health, in the city of Longmont for 25, almost a quarter of a century. So I'll leave it at that, and I'll turn it over to Carol for some of her history.
Well, I have a very different history. I'm a newer reader. I grew up very traditional Christian. As I went to college, I got into the New Age movement and science of mind and didn't find a lot of fruitfulness there. And that led to exploring Native American spirituality. We used to have a farm, and we had a sweat lodge ceremony every Sunday on our farm.
Mm.
And somehow I got my kids back to Sunday school, and the traditional Christian church became my home. And I led down this road of quite into fundamentalism. And when I met Mike, after a tragic loss of a husband, he was reading one day, and I looked over his shoulder and I said, "What is that?" I knew immediately. Mm. Whatever he was reading was important. And he said, "Are you interested?" And he gifted me that very first Christmas we were together, the Urantia book. And he's been reading to me almost every day for the last 5 years. We've been through the book sequentially. We're on our fifth read through. And we try to read a paper a day. And it is a lifeline. When I started reading with him, I said, "You know, I have years and years of Bible study, and I will find a mistake if there's one in here." And there was never a contradiction. There was only expansion. There was more truth than I could even imagine. And every day it expands. So that's my background with the book.
Yay.
Nice.
And you are an educator too as well, right? You've spent years.
Right. So my education, I didn't plan to be an educator. I planned to be a famous fashion designer in New York. And you know, those plans just don't go the way you we can all look back on our life, right?
Right.
I met a guy in New York and plans changed. But I started working with young people as I was raising five children. I started working with young people, and I saw the potential and the possibilities in each individual. I think my experience in design has taught me the uniqueness of design. And quite frankly, we're all designed. We're designed right by our Creator Son, by our God. I worked in youth leadership, and that led me to want to be back working with young people. And I called up the university, said, "What does it take?" They said, "Get a degree." I said, "Okay, sign me up." And that road opened up, and I had the most amazing, profound, beautiful career educating with leadership. I brought leadership into every class I worked with, every student. I believed in their possibilities. And I worked hard to try to make faculty see it that way too, instead of As Mike says, you know, the world looks through the lens of deficiency, but we look through the goodness. What is good and how does good expand?
The lens of potential.
Yes.
Yeah,
we're all going to move to perfection, so it starts now.
Yeah. Right. A dear friend once told me that the definition of education or the root of it, it comes from educare, which means to draw out. And so often it's about dumping in, right? And adding in.
I also want to make a comment. I have to, about Carol, I got to see how her students, younger folks, respond to Carol. And it was amazing when I got to experience that, and I'd go with her on some of her events up at Colorado State University, and her students just loved her and responded well to her, and I could see how when she taught they listened, and that relationship was amazing in terms of seeing what a teacher could potentially do, and how she got these folks to care for themselves. And she would tell me stories about how people would come into her office and kind of lay their tale of woe on her, and often, almost maybe every time, that tale of woe would turn into a leveraged opportunity to see the world differently. And I would hear those stories. It wasn't just from her. I would hear those stories from her students. And so, and by the way, she's a teacher in our school, our SOSIS school. And so that bodes well for anybody taking a class taught by Carol. And I've seen her in action in these classes. And again, people are just so connected to her. So I just wanted to bring that up about her capacity as a teacher. You know, our Creator's Son, while he was during his bestowal, was probably as much a teacher as anything else while he was here. And what a wonderful, profound, just incredible profession that we don't probably do enough for in our society in terms of seeing it for the value it has for the future of our society. And so anyway, Carol's a great teacher.
I can also teach you how to sew, and I just want to remind everybody that Jesus was a tent maker at
that's
one
right.
point.
That's right.
He was.
And a boat designer.
Both of you were in ministry professions, I would say, because what you did and what you've done is a service ministry. So, and it's interesting to me, so many Urantia book readers I know were in professions like that, in professions that serve people, and in the best ways. So, you know, it's only natural that you would come together. I said before we went on the air, you're such a dynamic duo, and I look at you at study group and I think, oh my God, they're amazing. And I thank God for you both that you came together and that you're doing this. So thank you. And what made you decide to take this big step? You said earlier before we went on the air that Andre played a part as well, which doesn't surprise me at all.
Well, you know, knowing part him, of it is we can go at it from the perspective of the deficiencies and what's absent. And oftentimes that's how we try to bring about change. What's absent and what's deficient. And it's easy to have those conversations with everybody in terms of let's look at the world as a problem to be solved. Let's look at other people as problems to be solved. Let's look at communities as problems to be solved. And we're coming at this from the perspective of what's present and what are the gifts and the goodness that's there. Now that might seem a little bit on the naive side, but you know, a lot of our teaching modality and our attributes that we discuss around statespeople stateswomen, statesmen. Just want to know if we use those terms interchangeably. Came from how Jesus taught, and I mean, his more or less his words were, "You're not going to banish evil. The best way to change this world is to add goodness." And the goodness, when expanded, and when you're looking at things of what's going well, what do we want to see more of? Where is the goodness? What are the possibilities? Expanding those things have a way of crowding out the things we don't want to see. And so that's our approach, and that's been our approach from the very beginning in terms of the change model that we use, whether it's helping shift a person or influence a person to kind of see the world differently, or how to influence the shift in an organization's culture, or how to shift a community from one that's kind of defined by either fear or its deficits or as a problem to one defined by generosity, gifts, and possibilities. And so that is the approach we're taking. And with every single class, and by the way, we have 45 different classes that
wow.
have been developed for this school. And we'll talk a little bit about those 45 classes, but they're each researched. By the way, our project team, which initially did include Andre, but I know Andre's life got busy and we missed him, but maybe there'll be a time down the road where he can rejoin. But you know, that's the direction that we're headed with those 45 courses. And on our project team for the development of all these courses are our elected officials. We have educators, former school superintendents, business people, lawyers, younger folks, and who else am I missing in terms of the demographics? But
Chamber of Commerce,
mm-hmm.
Journalists,
and so, you know, more or less facilitated by Carol and I in terms of the development of the school. But and so each of these classes have been researched or in the process of being researched to ensure that, you know, these classes are valid, reliable. And so there's a combination in each of these classes with of research that says, here's what the research shows. But we also, part of our goal is to create a different kind of future, a future that's different than the present or the past, that has that aliveness and being that we all want to live it to, and we all want to inhabit in a way that says this is where we want to be able to go in terms of how we are. So the School of Statesmanship, Stewardship and Service, SOSIS, is designed for elected officials. It's designed for elected official wannabes. It's designed for appointed officials. It's designed essentially right now for anyone who works with people in a way where they can have that kind of influence and maybe have a little bit of leverage with their network around bringing about a different kind of future than the one that exists now. And we can talk about what that future looks like. But that was, in essence, what we were trying to do. Now, this all started with an editorial that I wrote back in July of 21. And that, again, that editorial, and you've heard me say this already, served somewhat as an invitation. It was an invitation for people to become more involved with the development, the design, and the implementation of a School of Statesmanship. And 20 to 30 people, 25 people or so kind of signed up and said yes to that invitation. And so, you know, somewhat spawned, and I won't mention names here on the show, but it was somewhat spawned by an incident that occurred in our community in which two men who had big hearts, men who were very caring, men who had very much a service orientation with others, very intelligent, capable, accomplished people, kind of went to war with each other in the public, and it became personal. And of course, the media loved to dramatize that kind of divisiveness, and they didn't miss their chance on this one. And so, in essence, two people who were just absolutely incredible people and men, not only went to war with each other, but they also more or less recruited their respective camps to go to war with each other as well. And so that created a divisiveness in our community that that didn't feel well, didn't feel good. And so I didn't mention that in the editorial. But on the other hand, for me, it became kind of a personal kind of straw that broke the camel's back factor in terms of saying, you know, it's time. Mm. It's time to start looking at a school of statesmanship, because these two men, that if they could have combined and integrated and brought together their gifts, their strengths, their resources, their expertise, could have had a much different kind of impact on our community than the divisiveness path that they chose to go down. And so we see that a lot today, and that's the deficiency part. That's the deficiency part. It's easy to have those conversations. But we said there's so much more that we can do, because these men both have lots to offer. And so what can we do differently so that these offerings can be brought to life in a way that's good for the whole, good for the community, or good for our country, or good for the planet? So we went down this path of creating a purpose statement and then identifying and then developing these 45 different classes, courses that supported that purpose statement. And so, again, you can go on our website at SOSIS.org and look at our class offerings. We can talk about some of them, probably we'll talk about some of them today, but on the other hand, begin to see what's available. And we also wanted to make this, you know, and as you know, in Government on a Neighboring Planet, paper 72, it talks about national, regional, and state versions of the school of state or their college of statesmanship. And we wanted to make it replicable. This isn't something we want to say, well, it's just ours and no one else's. If there's anybody anywhere that would like to consider developing a school on this order, call it what you want, we are wide open to helping people figure that out, because it's something that we think is going to have to occur in terms of raising the level of thought, thinking, conversation, and changing the narratives around how we are with each other, who we are with each other, and that there's all of these incredible things going on in our midst that we can leverage and take advantage of to bring about something that's better than what exists today. And, you know, we've talked a lot about possibilities. We've talked some about possibilities and potential and opportunities. So in essence, that was kind of the humble beginning of the School of Statesmanship. You know, I first read about this when I was 25. Mm-hmm. And my profession, my career kept me busy for many years. And so when I left the profession, and when Carol left her profession, we chose to do this together. And so we're somewhat co-founders. And the project team we have is just an amazing group of men and women. And we're teaching classes now. We've been teaching classes. We have elected officials. We have business owners. We have, again, youth in our we've taught it to a group of college students as well. They were, and you know, part of what we're sensing, it doesn't matter how young or how old or where you come from or what ideological platform that you're attached to. People were drawn to this. They're hungry for something different. They're hungry for something more than what's happening now. And by the way, one of the ground rules for discussion with our project team and in our classes is that we are an ideology-free zone. And so for going on 2.5 years, we have kept that promise. There have been some that have come on trying to push their agenda in terms of their own ideology, and they didn't last long. because that was the ground rule we were living with. And to the person, the people that are engaged with this, to the person, and we have some very worldly accomplished people on this project team, say that the richest conversations they have in their lives are the conversations that involve the other members of SOSIS. And so,
nice.
So that's
very nice.
Kind of, that's a long answer, Paul, and some of that. But anyway, that's the humble beginning, and we're working through a lot of things right now. So.
Well,
yeah. Go ahead, Chuck.
No, I'm just going to say I'm really impressed by the work you guys are doing. Because, Mike, you were on the show before, right? That was a great show.
Restorative Justice.
Yeah,
part of what I want to say about that, Chuck, too, it's restorative justice, but the kind of the context for restorative justice are restorative principles and practices that can be applied anywhere. And when you begin to look at those principles, they're very much in alignment with fruits of the Spirit in terms of how we are with each other. And that's what heals. That's what brings about a different future. And, yeah, we utilize restorative principles and practices in a number of different ways in our work in this community. And that's it's a great example of focusing on possibilities, focusing on goodness, focusing on what do people have to offer versus kind of identifying them for something that a mistake they made or an action that they took. And we're all familiar with how Jesus had conversations, his own personal ministry, whether it was with his apostles or the trip to Rome or the trip to the Caspian Sea. You know, the one that stands out for me is when he encountered Fortune, F-R-O-T-U-N-E, in the mountains and introduced him to the happiness highways, so to speak. And so, in essence, those things were restorative. It happens to be entitled Restorative Principles, Practice, and Justice. But you're right. We talked about that before, Chuck.
But this whole class conception that you put together with all these courses, I mean, that's just been the last couple of years. Since we talked, since you were on the show before.
Yeah, so we started when the first 25 pulled together, we said what would be important to understand as a statesman. Now, I will say if you look up the editorial from July 2021, Mike had, he outlined the attributes and character of a statesman. And we put that into a presentation and showed it to a couple of Rotary clubs, and people said, oh, we need this. That was always the response. We need this because civility and a higher order of civilization is where we're headed. And we are at a point where we all know that we can be better communicators.
Mm-hmm.
We can have higher cognitive thinking. So the group, we spent months just on what would the topics be, what would be important. And, you know, I will say from my background in education, as I worked on my PhD and I ran the internship program, so I sat on task force with the Department of Labor and workforce training. And I like that Mike made a statement of anybody who works with people. Well, guess what? We all work with people, right?
Yes. We do.
And the reality is, and you know, as we would sit around these task force, and there would be other university people there, and the it came up a lot about 21st century. You all have heard the term soft skills, correct? Yes. And I say those are the most difficult skills to teach, to develop, and to practice, and to form into really great habits. Mm. Now, if you read the book, you see the display. It talks all the time, and I love to talk about Andre sat in our living room one night, and I was struggling, and he explained the mind spirits to me in such a way that all of a sudden I understood what was happening. Mm. And Andre, you may not remember that night, but I do. It has played into, putting together classes around emotional intelligence. And those are some of the competencies that the education world understands. And, of course, we all come from the revelation of what is actually happening and how do you combine all of that in a class and teach it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I really like how you draw the connection between civility and civilization. that's often lost. I mean, people think of civilization as some big abstract thing that's sort of maybe happening, sort of not. But civility is something, it's a day-to-day thing, where we can choose to be civil and learn about what that even means. But this idea that they're connected, civilization grows from civil behavior, I just think it's such an important just even conceptual leap to make or to grasp in all this. Yeah. So I'm really, really excited about what you guys are doing.
Yeah, me too. And I want to ask you, is that paper that Mike wrote, the editorial, is that available on your site, your SOSIS site?
I'm posting it in the chat right now, so you'll be able to see it, okay?
Okay, great. Thank you, Andre.
Here's the link. It's
from
the Longmont Times call, July 6th, 2021, and it was Mike Butler on the qualities of statesmanship.
The qualities of statesmanship.
All of that with,
I can't wait to read
all of that with hyphens in between. And those of you that are on the board can click on the link. I don't know that it would be helpful for us to read it on the air, but you can go to www.timescall.com, and if you search for Mike Butler statesmanship, it should come up.
Right.
You could even just Google it.
Yeah.
I just Googled it, and it comes
it's
up as one of the fourth or fifth items.
Man, maybe you can post it on your site too. That would be a great thing to have, your founding, your inspiration there. But I also wanted to ask Mike, you said this problem cropped up in the community between these two men. Boy, that's a familiar, is that a familiar story. I mean, we could take that and all over the world, we're being dragged into divisive issues by two people who have a disagreement, right? And because they happen to be high profile, now a lot of people are involved with their disagreement. It's just like a divorce or anything. It happens on a small level, but it also happens on a big level, and we see it all the time. But you said our community, were they in Longmont? Was it a Longmont thing?
Yeah. It was a Longmont. It was a Longmont-based set of circumstances, and so
you remember the phrase, don't you? The Jesus phrase. Can anything good come out of Longmont? Well, apparently, yes.
I love Longmont.
That was the phrase, Longmont. Yeah.
Okay. So I just wanted to be clear on that. Because it's for me, when you talk about restoring something, probably one of the primary things that I see when I look at the world that needs to be restored is our faith in each other. Our belief that we all mean well and we all intend to do the right, sure, there's exceptions. Of course there are. But in my experience, most people want to do the right thing. They may not always know exactly what that is, but most people I've ever met want to do the right thing, want to make a difference, want to be a good person, you know. And I think that somehow when you get into a divisive situation, we lose faith in each other. And it spirals down from there. And so statesmanship
is
so important in that regard.
I'd like to build on what you just said. It's critically important. Mm-hmm. And we know why people want to do the right thing. I mean, we know that they're indwelled with a fragment of God. We know that Spirit of Truth is hovering around them. We know that there's these other spirit aids that are trying to spiritize each and every human being. And so that plays out. And part of what we haven't done is to take advantage and to say, okay, how can we work in partnership with these spirit aids in a way that can really make a difference? And so our school is very much aligned with that. And a large segment of the courses, a number of courses that we teach, are very much in alignment with what you just said. And mm-hmm. I'll kind of rephrase it a little bit here, though, Paula, and that is we believe everyone has gifts, resources, expertise, talents, skills, something to offer. And yet, because of the way we're designed right now, structurally, either as communities, states, or a country, or typically it's the experts, it's the service providers, it's the systems folks, it's, quote, the leaders that are become more important. And I'm not saying that they're not important. They are. But one of the phrases that we use is that those are important, but what makes great communities? And we can even expand that to what makes a great country or what makes a great planet are great citizens. Mm. And so what can states people do to kind of leverage that in a way that says, okay, each of these people has something good inside of them. They have gifts, they have talents, and they have capacities. And on top of that, as you said, and my own personal experience and the work that I've done in my own personal life is that they want to offer those gifts. They want to offer. They have these offerings. But they just don't know how. They don't know if they have permission.
Mm.
They don't know if they're, what they have to offer will make a difference. And so a lot of people get lost in the in that milieu of, someone else is going to be responsible for dealing with the woundedness of a community or the woundedness of a society or a country. And they're the ones who are responsible. And so, and that's some of the mantra right now is, you know, we can blame our leaders for the things that are going wrong and in the same breath kind of declare our own innocence. And in that way, not take responsibility and accountability for being our brother's keeper, because we've been kind of school, skilled, and trained in the belief that our government entities or our nonprofits or someone else who's really officially in charge because they have these officially sanctioned jobs are going to be the ones who are going to fix everything. Mm-hmm. And we're coming from the perspective of, no, we need each and every human being. That's the essence of where we're going with this. We want people to sort of reclaim their citizenship in a way that's good for everybody, that where they can begin to be part of enhancing a community's wellness or, you know, whenever I say community, I also mean country and planet and whatever that looks like for them. And they can be there for as well. And they can take their God-given talents, gifts, or leverage their own spirit aids in a way that can make a difference for others and help the healing that we need, where we need to heal and expand the goodness where it can be expanded. And so we spend a considerable amount of time Now, what I don't know is I don't have access to the curriculum of the School of Statesmanship on the continental nation, on a government, or on a neighboring planet. But boy, I would bet that this is part of what they teach, given what we know, what happened, what was happening in government on a neighboring planet, is that each and every person has this responsibility to the good of the whole. It's not just individual rights without responsibilities. It's individual rights with responsibility to something larger than you. That's one of the things that I noted about that whole government on a neighboring planet, is that it's very much aligned with the balance of rights of people versus rights of the larger whole, whatever that might look like, community, country, planet. And so I bet they teach in their curriculum, in their school, in their college of statesmanship, you know, what's that look like in, for you in terms of what you choose to be accountable for, or what you choose to commit to, or what actions you're willing to take that can make a difference for others, and that they teach their leaders, their statespeople, on how to do just that, on how to activate that social capital, how to surface it, how to activate it, and how to coordinate it. And social capital are, for me, the gifts, the talents, skills, resources, because it's so much in abundance. And this has to come from that perspective of abundance versus that perspective of scarcity, in which people believe that there's enough, that they're enough, that the neighborhood has enough, the community has enough, and that we have enough already. All we have to do is somehow surface it, activate it, and coordinate it. But it's going to take all of us, and whether it's in a community or in a country or wherever, and that no one has the kind of luxury of sitting back on the sidelines and saying someone else is going to do it for me. And so what that looks like in the long run has a lot of ramifications in terms of the shifting that needs to occur, whether it's in communities, country, or planet, around how we are with each other and what that means. And I'm convinced, given what we've read, in the Urantia papers, is that that's kind of the direction we think it's going to go. And so our School of Statesmanship, Stewardship, and Service, SOSIS, has kind of taken on that aspect of what leaders are responsible for. They're not just responsible for giving the answers. We teach classes on how to ask powerful questions that can help people discover their own gifts, their own talents, get moved beyond the box they might be stuck in or wherever they might be stuck. And we also teach the people in our classes, the future leaders or the leaders that are current, how to engage in transformational conversations that are different than the conversations they're having now. And by the way, they're all aligned with what we're reading in the fifth revelation. They're all aligned with how Jesus asked questions, or the kind of conversations he had. Conversations around commitment, conversations around possibility, action, ownership, conversations around gifts. You know, one of the hard conversations we can have anymore, about how can you get someone to recognize what their profound gifts are, what they can offer. What's that look like in terms of the question you ask or the conversation you have, that they can begin to see what their offerings are and what difference they can make with their fellow people in an organization, a neighborhood, a community. So our statesmen, stateswomen, statespeople are taught these things in ways that can, you know, we hope that, you know, that's what they leave with, so that they're not just sitting up there like two birds feeding, or a bird feeding a nest of baby birds, and that's all they want is to be fed. But what role can a leader play in terms of activating the social capital wherever they're at? And that's in essence what Rodin talked about a lot in terms of social, individual and social maturity. That's what Jesus spoke about a lot in terms of you know, the responsibility of service to your fellow man and being your brother's keeper. I mean, and so we're kind of coming at it. Well, those are the fruits of the Spirit. This is a secular school around leveraging the fruits of the Spirit in a way that makes sense for whatever organization you're in, whatever government entity you're in, wherever you might be in terms of advancing the cause of civility. Our byline is creating evolved civility that Chuck is so right on in terms of how much that will make a difference in terms of creating a society or civilization that has so much more social capital going for it than it once did. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the specific things that I always got caught, people would want to catch me up in the role I played was, you know, hey, Butler, what's important in terms of, you know, all this violence that we're seeing? Should we have stricter gun laws, or should we do away with guns, or should we add more guns? Because, you know, there's two sides to that everywhere we go. And I know there's a section in, I think it was in the Urmia section, where basically the midwares discussed it wasn't an issue of armament or disarmament as much as it was an issue of civility. And so you can apply it at that level in terms of, you know, if we can somehow advance the cause of civility and create more civility, it won't make any difference whether someone has a gun or doesn't have a gun. And I don't want to get into that specific argument, but that was one of the things that I learned about from the Urantia papers around that particular issue. So anyway,
we can talk
about that a little bit.
Here's a quote from the Urantia book, just to cap off what you just said, and we were talking about why we could have faith in each other, and this is from paper 171, the Jesus Papers, section 7, paragraph 8. It says, the master could discern saving faith in the gross superstition of the woman who sought healing by touching the hem of his garment. He was also ready and willing to stop a sermon or detain a multitude while he ministered to the needs of a single person, even to a little child. Great things happened, not only because people had faith in Jesus, but also because Jesus had so much faith in them.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I think that is the essence of it. If I'm understanding you correctly, we can all be statesmen. And no matter what job we're in, right, no matter what we're doing, as Carol pointed out, you know, there's nothing, almost nothing we can do that doesn't involve interaction with other human beings, and opportunities to have deep conversations, meaningful conversations, enlightening, empowering. And, you know, it seems to me like whatever we can do to lower the temperature right now is a good thing. And I think that's why people are telling you, we need this, right? Because maybe we all believe that we can do it, we just don't know how. And we don't have the tools in our little toolbox and abilities to be able to lower the temperature, which would be vastly beneficial for everybody, anybody, you know. So thank you.
There's two things. There are two things that I've just noticed already that you guys have brought up that I just like to underscore, because they're things I've been thinking a lot about. And one of them is the idea of individual responsibility for the good of the whole. That sort of, you know, getting that idea going, that we're each responsible for the good of the whole, and what role can we play to make that happen. And there's a level of accountability that I think could have a very big and healing and important role. And the other is you've made the connection between principles and practices. I love hearing that, too, because I thought a lot about that. I did a workshop on that at the last conference. About principles and practices. So, you know, how those are related, how one flows into the other. So I just want to underscore those two. Mm-hmm. They're both kind of principles in themselves. They're almost like meta principles.
Thanks, Chuck.
So if you have anything to add on those two points, I'd be very curious to hear.
Yeah, very important. You know, when we address, as we came up with the themes, and then we moved to outlining each class to a know, and then an understand, and then a do. So if you can relate that to the practices and principles, know is, from an academic scholarship point of view, you know, I go in to try to find what's the most current research. What's really interesting to me is that science is starting to explore the, and I'm not sure what the words are, maybe the invisible, the forces, the things that we know about, certainly from reading the Revelation and opening up to our own understanding, our higher mind. And that's what I'm excited about. I think that we are in this new frontier. And yet, I want to go back to Paula, what a beautiful reading in that Jesus paper. The technology that we are under, especially the younger generations, they're using so many tools and so many screen minds, you know, in front of them, that they have not developed the skills and the abilities and the practice of relating to another person and developing that that empathy, that social connectedness. We finished up a group of classes called Identifying Strengths last week, and the neuron links that happen when people are in this kind of like-mindedness. We know it as spiritual connectivity. We know it, you know, as the God part of us talking to the other God part of us, right? We know that.
Right.
And how do we, again, expand that where it's understood, it's practiced, it's a principle of how we relate to one another, and then we build from there. We make something greater.
Mm. Beautiful. Yeah, what were the three things you said, Carol? You said
understanding, and doing.
It's wonderful. Wonderful themes there. And, you know, I'm looking at your modules right now, and I think it would be useful to our listening audience to just hear some of the course titles and going through some of these things. And I'm wondering if you wouldn't mind commenting on some of these. You have these 45 courses basically broken up into three modules: a statesmanship, a service, and a stewardship module. And then you have those, each of the 15 courses under each of those, broken up into three sections that are essentially five courses apiece. And these are standalone. Are these 1 week courses? The way they work, is that practically how that works?
Yeah. So we like for people to take the five weeks. So we just finished up the Identifying Strengths. The first week was mindfulness. They're 3-hour classes. Now they're in person. We are working to add a virtual in-person possibility. Not done yet, but we're hoping for that for the April, May, the next set of classes. And then we went into self-awareness. You know, how do you start to really get to know yourself? when we built out the three pillars, the first one of statesmanship was really about the self. You know, how do you grow and understand and love and become aware of yourself? I think so often in life we take what others are telling us about ourselves and not going to that inner place of really getting to know thyself.
Right.
And so it starts with communication, right? You have to, like the first five classes are the first class after the qualities and attributes, which Mike does so beautifully. And he is available, I will say, for any audience, he is available to put that presentation out, because I think it just gives us this higher ideal of, you know, what are the things that you could think about that would improve your life, improve every relationship you have. And most of it is, you know, listening actively and reflectively and being there for another person. And then being able to have discourse and instead of always having to get the argument ready and have your reply ready, you're really listening, and then you're using your cognitive faculties to come up with the next question that you can understand each other greater. And the metacognitive, just understanding the brain science. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Our brain.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, right. And if I can just even go through and read through some of these, and you just stop me when you want to comment on something. Your 101 is what you've been going through, the effective communicators, qualities and attributes of statespeople, just talking about, I imagine, those qualities, active and empathetic listening, as you were saying, civil discourse, quality conversations, extending inquiry, metacognitive skills. So, you know, basically learning about learning in a certain sense. In becoming an effective statesperson. And I like how you're interchangeable with the language. You know, you're accommodating the fact that it's really changed, that the idea of going statesman can be a problem for some people. And in your courses, you've changed that. But in heading it up, you're not overly concerned about language. You're actually showing that people can communicate with each other and accommodate both styles, and that it's not favoring one gender or another.
Good point. New challenges for statesmanship.
We spent several meeting times on it, and
I remember
one of our project team came back, and she's a state legislator now, and she said it's like sportsmanship. Sportsmanship is a state of being. I like to call it, statesmanship is a state of being the best version of you that gets better every day.
Yeah, wonderful. Well, then
that's,
you go to the next
definition.
Module. Sorry?
Go ahead, Andre. I just wanted to say statesman, you know, if you look up statesman in the dictionary, it says a skilled, experienced, and respected political leader or figure. But that's not what we're talking about. And, you know, that's part of it. I mean, anybody, a political leader can certainly be a statesperson. But if I'm understanding, you're going beyond just that, someone who's in a position of leadership and saying, you know, we can all be skilled statespeople. So, but go ahead, Andre.
Yeah, I like the general thing of that. We're all part of a state, so each one of us could be
true.
Focus on our state personness.
Right. And most of us are leaders
member.
Of somebody.
Yeah, that's more like citizenship. You know, being an effective citizen. But it's kind of putting it in this context. kind of puts another layer of possibility, even on the individual, right, regardless of whether they're in government or not.
Right.
Well, if you don't change the leader, right, nothing changes. And it seems to me that leaders going in without having changed themselves first are some of the ones that are causing the most problems. The next thing you do is you go to your next section, your next submodule, identifying strengths. And this is very interesting, being present, mindfulness, self-awareness, emotional intelligence, identifying strengths in self and others, and social intelligence. What do you want to say about that particular module, that one that apparently you've just concluded now?
Mm-hmm. Well, being present, being able to focus on another person and to connect with another person is a human skill that has maybe been lost due to the frantic pace we're living at and the many things on our to-do list and the technology, the watches, the phones, the, you know, everything that is in our midst. And so that ability to give attention and awareness, we put people through an assessment and it starts into this understanding of your brain, I love to talk about our electrochemical mortal body and how we start to live higher than all the electrochemical that is happening to us, right?
Well,
let me just say a little bit about that course on presence to mindfulness. And, we basically, you know, we talk, I mean, part of this section is about being other-centered versus self-centered.
Mm-hmm.
And what's that look like in a lot of different circumstances, especially when you're a leader or a parent or a someone who has some kind of influence with people,
right.
What's that look like? And do you want to become that, by the way? Is that something you want to be able to do? And we talk about the benefits of becoming other-centered versus self-centered, including having a lot more energy because it's not about you. And you're not worried about your own agenda, that this is related to other people. And that sense of presence for others is a real gift. And if people know that you as a leader are present for them, there's an old saying that goes, I don't care how much you know until I know how much you care.
Mm-hmm.
And that
right.
comes a lot for people when they know that you're present. And we've all been around folks in our lives where we really felt their presence. And it is a real gift. And it's one of the things our creator son, while sojourning as a mortal on this planet, was outstanding at. In the moment, he could be present for anybody. And those people felt that presence, and you extended it a little bit, maybe a lot of it, Paula, when you said, because he had such great faith in them.
Right.
And so with that presence comes this sense of confidence, the sense of you are enough, you're more than enough, you have all these incredible gifts. And you know, you go back to that conversation that Jesus had with Fortune, and he talked about all the gifts he had and all the strengths he had and all the beautiful qualities that he had, to the point where Fortune was ready to listen to him talk about the happiness highways. And so There's a. It's not a secret as much as it is a way of being, and so we spend quite a bit of time on what that means, and we take our participants through a number of exercises so that they understand what that can feel like for them personally being present, and for others that they're present for. And so that's part of the, you know, the know is what we want people to know, the understand is what we want people to understand, and the do is what is the application of the know and understand. Mm-hmm. So we, you know, these are experiential courses, they're educational, and they're practical in terms of how they're designed. And so that becomes critically important. And Carol does just such a masterful job on the whole emotional intelligence piece. Mm-hmm. And then the social intelligence piece as well. We even have a Urantia book reader in our classes. So we're making progress here, folks, in terms of expanding our demographics.
We have one. If we get another one, we'll have a 100% increase. That would be great.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
We'll double.
Can you give us an example, maybe, of one of your exercises, that one of the things you do to create any one of these, self-awareness or emotional intelligence? Or, I think, Carol, you mentioned that you go through some exercises. You did too, Mike. So is there one that sticks out as a kind of an aha moment for most people that they gives them a real, insight?
One of the things we teach is the we give them a question. And we say, we want each of you to ask each other that question. And then we want you to listen to the answer and then to come back and talk about what that was like for you. Because they're very seldom in a mode of being able to ask powerful questions. One of the questions we ask is what are you grateful for that has gone unspoken, that you have not talked about yet? What's that look like? And you know, I would just let you know that we talk a little bit about some of the keys to putting a powerful question together. Is number one, it's personal. Number two, it can create a little bit of anxiety. And number three, there's no yes or no. There's some ambiguity attached to these questions. And there's more to it in terms of how it's set up and all that. But and so they're not used to asking questions of anyone. They're not used to doing that. Leaders are used to giving answers. And so now they have to ask a question. So how does that feel to you? And it can invoke emotion, those kinds of questions. Or what do you contribute to that which you complain about the most? Or what gift do you have?
That's a good one.
That's a very good one, yeah.
What gift do you have that the world doesn't know about?
Ooh.
Or how valuable of an experience, how valuable of an experience do you intend for this evening to be? What's that mean?
Wow.
So when they ask each other these questions, and there's an art and science to asking these questions, and we have you can literally make up hundreds of these given the circumstances around possibility, commitment, dissent, gifts. When they're in these modes of asking each other these questions, there is something that they have to turn on within themselves in terms of their own awareness and consciousness that maybe they haven't done, or maybe they're not used to, or maybe something they don't practice. And so that's an example of the application aspect of this.
One thing on the last section, and we have other people who teach classes. So, Stephanie, as we were putting the classes together, of course, people, especially the what are your strengths or what's your personality, you know. Like, what are the different personality types? And as you go back in psychology, which personality labels did you go under? And we decided, okay, we can't do that, because that puts people in a place where then they can use it as an excuse. Oh, well, I'm just I'm an introvert. And so I don't have social awareness and connection because that's just who I am. That's the way I was created, and that's the way I'm going to be, right? Well, that doesn't lead to any kind of growth and more maturity. I just get to tell you guys this. I laugh because when I put the emotional intelligence slides together, I put up Rodin. And I'm very careful. You know, I come from an academic background, and so I cite, and I spent a lot of time in the books and the research. And there was a slide that came up that in the Rodin papers on maturity requires work and work requires energy. Do you all know that part?
Yeah.
Of the Rodin paper?
Mm-hmm.
And it was up on, and I go, I didn't cite this. And luckily we had a Urantia book reader that said, that's Rodin. I go, oh, Rodin, a philosopher from Alexandria, Egypt. So I did cite one part. I did have it on the next slide. But it was so profound and in alignment with how we were teaching that this does require work. Chuck, I think you brought up with the principles and the practices. This isn't something you do once and you have it. This is something you are made aware of through these three-hour sessions. And, of course, we give a lot of resources to people. But on the identifying strengths, they were taken through, you know, identify three moments in your life that were really challenging for you. And they spent 20 minutes writing of, you know, go back to that memory. What happened? How did you move through it? People often don't give themselves enough credit of their own advancing maturity, their advancing spiritual abilities, their advancing social connections. They're overcoming challenging situations. It's woven through the book, right? In terms of how is it that you grow as a person?
So anyway, that was that second section, and then the third section we're going to be teaching.
Yeah.
April 11th through the May 9th, and this is where kind of some of the rubber meets the road a little bit about how to shift cultures to transcend cultures, whether it's an organizational culture, whether it's a community culture, whatever that might look like, what you can do, what are the specific steps, what's the sequence. What kind of time frame? What's the pace? A lot of things go into the idea of shifting your culture. And I come from the world of policing, and we're all familiar with some of the incidents that have occurred over the last 10 years, all the way back to Ferguson and George Floyd and several others. And whenever you saw a talking head or a pundit on TV, they would say, well, cultural policing needs to change. And someone would come on and say, well, we're going to give all of our police officers body-worn cameras, or we're going to change a policy that has everything to do with use of force, or we're going to change the structure of our organization, whatever that might look like, along those lines. And none of them got it engaged in what really the depth of what real cultural change and shifts look like. And what we have discovered, and maybe some of you can speak to this, but very few elected officials especially understand what that means in terms of shifting culture, or very few organization CEOs understand what that looks like. Very few government leaders understand what that looks like. And so we're going to spend quite a bit of time in this next section of classes discussing what it does look like. and what it takes and what it means in terms of the shifts you're going to be making. And again, specifically the skill sets that you'll need, the maybe a starting point and a sequence, what the PACE, the P-A-C-E, might look like in terms of your own organization or your own community. One of the things we haven't talked about yet is TOSIS is kind of going into a – we have an agreement with two national police organizations to teach cultural – the shifting of cultures within police and community across the country. And so they're going to be utilizing our curriculum. And we're working right now with two police, national police organizations. This is kind of a sub-side thing that we just kind of worked into. It gets beyond the classes that we're teaching. But we're going to be, you talk about a criminal justice system, a police profession, and a community. For instance, in the community, you look at a community right now, and I can virtually guarantee you there's probably not a community in America that doesn't have an unhealthy dependency on their police department.
Wow.
And the point that we're making is that you can't shift and change the culture in a police department until you shift and change the culture of a community from one of unhealthy dependency to one of interdependency. And what's that look like? What do you need to go through in order to shift that in a way where you become a lot less dependent on police and become more interdependent, not only with the police services in your community, but also with each other and amongst each other. And once you've accomplished that, you can virtually see the change that will take place inside of a police department. Now we'll also teach mayors, city managers, and sheriffs and police chiefs from around the country what it means to shift a culture within the police department as well to accommodate a partnership relationship versus a patriarchal relationship. And so right now, the vast majority of police departments have a very patriarchal relationship with their communities. What's it look like to have a culture, an internal culture that supports partnership? What's that look like in terms of the people you hire, how you train, how you supervise, even the architecture of your organization, your performance management systems, your budgets, all your support administrative services? I'm getting into the weeds a little bit here, but you can apply that to just about any institution in government, not just police. Police are typically the most visible because of the nature of the work that happens. But so anyway, that's a big part of that third section. And
can you
so,
say a little bit?
That's coming up.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about fostering respect. I see that on that list for that last part, last piece. I wonder if you could say a little bit more about
the part
about
of
that.
what we're you bet. Thank you for that question, Chuck. So one of the classes is fostering respect, and one of the things we teach our statesmen, what's that look like for you in terms of fostering respect? How can you foster respect for yourself? How can you foster respect between you and others? How can you help between others foster respect? What are those steps? What are the skill sets necessary? What are the things you need to be thinking about? Because there are a lot of folks who don't feel like they're respected, or they don't realize or see that their voice counts or thoughts matter. And so what can we do to help foster a kind of respect that engenders empathy, that engenders understanding, that engenders a sense that they are valued, that they're recognized, and that they can, in fact, kind of reciprocate that sense of being valued and being recognized to others. And so it's not just the leader's responsibility to foster respect, although that's where we're starting in this class, but it's also the leader's responsibility to ensure that the culture itself fosters respect and that there is a sense.
Yeah.
Sorry?
Oh, I was just going to say, it seems like one of the first things that's lost when there's conflict. If there's conflict, it's like respect is out the window.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we easily migrate default to conflict. So we will have discussions in that class around, you know, not necessarily how to avoid conflict, but how to enhance the capacity for respect to emerge. And that's the way we come at this. We don't necessarily come at it and say, here's all the deficiencies. We come at it and say, here's what exists that helps us get to that place.
I think, we're working at those classes right now, and cultural competencies is coming in, you know, understanding where people have come from. But also this getting out of this grouping, the labeling, what's boxing us in, being able to identify even, you know, this will be like self-awareness, but now, oh, it's a group, you know, what is it that I have allowed to box myself in and keep other people out because it is us versus them and breaking that down.
Here's a great comment on the board that I want to share with you both, because I think you probably heard this before, and it comes up a lot in our public discussions, and at least I hear it from people. A person on the board just said, this is hard to do when you live in a system that is inherently corrupt on a mass scale. How do you counter that? I guess all hope is lost. And I know Mike and Carol, I'd love to hear your response to this because.
I would welcome a discussion with that person about that conclusion, number one, and would welcome that because we can probably have a discussion about to what level that exists or doesn't exist. Without that, chances are that probably won't happen. But without that, I would enjoy having a conversation around where do you start? You just give up? You just say, it's just going to continue to be corrupt. It continues to just throw everything out, start over again. Or do you kind of let the powers of the universe play a larger part in terms of neutralizing or maybe eliminating what is deficient, what's wrong, what we need to kind of fix or problem solve. And so we're coming at it from the perspective of no matter where we're at, who we're with, or what the concerns might be, is that there is enough there that we wouldn't be there in the first place if people didn't want to see something better happen. They didn't want to see goodness prevail. And so we're going to come at it from that perspective. And, you know, as your Ranch Book readers, we believe in those, those kind of fruits of the spirit or the powers of the universe, whether it's generosity, kindness, love, service, that they have much, much more power. And so what do we need to do to bring them into the moment, make them present, and to expand them becomes the nature of the discussion that we would have with any group that we're working with. And so that's kind of where we end up going. And I believe me, in my own work in the world of policing, I won't tell you what it was like when I first got to the job I got to, but other than to say that primitiveness prevailed. And so where, how do you take it from that place of primitiveness to another place becomes a labor of love. It becomes a process that is going to take time, over time, and that we're going to have to figure out, you know, a lot of things along the way. And as always, evolution doesn't come without regressions. And so there's always three steps forward, two steps back, but you have to keep your eyes on the prize. And part of what you have to sustain is an unassailable conviction around what you believe. And I'm hoping that your answer book readers, I mean, of all the people that I believe that should be have the most hope on this planet, it's your answer book readers.
Good point.
And because they're the ones who know where we're all headed.
Undying hope.
And so, in fact, that is that's one of the spirits, fruits of the spirit, is undying hope, courageous loyalty, loyalty, unfailing goodness. Merciful ministry, forgiving intolerance, unselfish devotion, loving service, enduring peace, sincere fairness, all those become part of how you are with people.
Right.
And so I get, you know, Jesus walked onto this planet and walked into the nest of the Sanhedrin. And so it's still taking some time. So anyway, it's a... some of these, but I would want to make a case that not everybody, everything is like that. That there are probably pockets where that exists more than others, but that undying hope is where we have to start.
I'd like to add. So one of the philosophies we brought in. And this is based on what's happening in education. The critical thinking, critical theories, the breaking down, having skepticism, I think is outdated. There was a shift about 10 years ago into design thinking, into creating, into how do you make a system into the vision that you can have for it. And I would ask for the person on the board to envision what does a system, Mike is in discussions often with authors and thought leaders, And the topic comes up, well, the institutions are just so large and they're just so powerful and there's nothing that can change them. And that's just not design thinking. Design thinking says we can shift. We don't have to break them down and start over. We can make an institution. The institution was created by us in the first place, and we can make it what it needs to be to meet the needs of the people that are us. And it won't be perfect. It will evolve. But envisioning what you want in life is very different than saying, okay, here's where the problem is, and we have to go after this person and fix it. And that's very aligned with how Mike talks about goodness all the time. The goodness will expand and crowd out what we don't want to see. And we look at the world as a white background with it. I don't know where that is in the papers. White background with dark spots versus the dark background and a few light spots.
Yeah, I can't forget that phrase either. So
that's essentially the essence of Jesus's teachings, what you just said, Carol. It's the essence that, you know, love, and Mike, you say this all the time, love is what will change it. But we've never had the courage to try that, right? Goodwill, peace, understanding, sympathetic understanding. All of these things, it seems to me that you're teaching, which, of course, you know, Jesus was the master statesman. He's the statesman of the universe. And he came and he gave our world a class. He's cool.
He did.
Yeah.
36-year class.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
yeah, we have a wonderful
profoundly.
Textbook, don't we?
Oh, man. We're blessed. We're so blessed. And it's so diverse. It's so rich. You know, I know I read that you guys were inspired by Rodin, a lot of what Rodin said. Wow. Rodin's teachings are so rich. And that's just one paper in the book. But, yeah. But you know, to have Jesus in his fullness, to have this master class taught by this master statesman in its fullness, in his fullness, you know, if you don't come away saying, I can do better, I can be better, you know, this attitude, I think, that troubles me a lot is this attitude of burning everything down. You know, I've heard a lot lately, mm-hmm. let's turn down the temperature. And one of my dear friends used to say, that's honest, but it puts off a lot of heat and not a lot of light. And light is what we need right now, not heat. Yeah. Heat is what burns it all down. Let's just burn it all down and hope that, you know, we don't just destroy whatever civilization and civility we have. Because I'm mad and I don't like the way it is right now. Well, okay, but maybe you can approach it in a different way. Maybe you can approach it with love. Maybe you can approach it with patience and understanding. Go ahead, Mike.
The question I would ask is what I mentioned earlier. What are you contributing to that you're complaining about? And you set right. that up in a way where it's not, it doesn't sound like it's offensive. But the other part of this is a lot of people think that this approach has a naivete attached to it. There isn't. Believe me, I can speak to a number of circumstances in my own personal and professional experiences where this way was by far the most profoundly effective way to go about it than, okay, well, let's pass more laws or let's create more policies or let's stiffen penalties as if those things would serve as an insurance policy that might protect us from the human condition. And I can guarantee you, as for as many years as I've been doing this work, I've never seen a law fix a social or health issue, ever.
Ooh.
And
wow.
The codification of anything typically comes after the values in place. And once the values mm-hmm. in place, then you don't need the law necessarily. But on the other mm-hmm. hand, it's a here's what we need to do. And so we're coming at this. In this whole school with an entirely different perspective than trying to say, here's why you need to be afraid. We're going to market the fear. We're going to market the fault. We're going to exploit people's wounds. We're going to find retributive responsibility for what's going on. That is the current narrative, and that's the current response based in fear. A lot of policy mm-hmm. and laws get passed in a fear-based environment. And so we're coming at it from an entirely different perspective. And you know, and if you believe anything that the Urantia book says, I just don't know if there's another way. But we also are not naive. We realize that agendas exist. We realize that folks – there's a lot of self-interest that still prevails and that some of these agendas are hidden. Many mm-hmm. of us have dealt with those things over the years and we teach in our classes how to deal with hidden agendas, how to deal with self-interest, how to deal with resistance that come from cynics or victims or bystanders. There's actual skill sets on how to deal with that kind of resistance that at the very least neutralizes it and at the very most maybe makes converts. But on the other hand, those are things that we also need to teach, because the person who asked that question is, I understand why that question gets asked, but we're absolutely convinced that there are ways of dealing with the underpinnings of bad policy, of loyalties that are misplaced, of lack of integrity, whatever that might look like, and certainly resistance, and so in a lot of different forms. And so those are also classes and skill sets that we teach in this. And the one thing that I was going to mention earlier that we also spend quite a bit of time on is rethinking the purpose of our institutions in this country.
Wow.
And we spend quite a bit of time on that.
How timely is that?
And,
yeah.
You know, and we all know about Paper 87, Section 7. And some of what we teach is related to that, from that, in terms of what can help create a culture that's alive, flexible, life-giving, sustains itself, it works for the good of the whole, respects each independent person and respects the collective. And what do those look like in terms of repurposing institutions in a way that you go from one that's egocentric to one where applied love becomes the way an institution works? And so,
wow.
You know what? It's time to start teaching these things. And it's time to start talking about them in ways that they haven't been talked about. And that's what SOSIS is doing.
In applications that haven't been used before, you know, they've not been applied. What you're saying is, like with the police departments, they're being applied now to institutions that maybe haven't really tried them yet, but could benefit greatly from
and
that.
I won't go to the point of saying if you can do it in police, you can do it just about any institution, but I'm real close to that.
Good for you.
Because,
knows whereof he speaks, too.
It's a... You know, I mean, we know about religious institutions. We know about education institutions. We know about medical institutions. We know about other governmental institutions. There's other institutions that don't necessarily have that kind of framework. But on the other hand, if you can shift it in the world of public safety, police and fire, I'll throw fire in there as well. I'm convinced you can do it in most. So. That's kind of where we're coming from.
Well, I don't know if the person on the board, esotericism, was Patrick. He's not calling in. Apparently power went out. He was calling in from Stone Mountain in Georgia. And, you know, I got to an idea as to where his question was coming from. And in the first place, you know, he said, you know, he largely agrees with what we're talking about. And in fact, he's on here now. I'm going to let him capture his question for us now, if that's okay. Are you ready to
Absolutely.
Take a call, Mike? Very
Absolutely.
Good. Here's Patrick from Stone Mountain, Georgia.
Before you put him on, Andre, let's just be mindful. We have 16 minutes left, and we want to give Mike and Carol a chance to tell us all how we can participate in this.
We will. So,
okay.
If you can keep it to a couple of minutes, and then take your answer off the air, that'd be great. Patrick, welcome to the Cosmic Citizen.
Oh, thank you. Ironically, my power went out in the whole neighborhood. So I missed what you guys were talking about in like the last couple of minutes. So I wasn't able to hear any of that.
Go ahead and recap your question, because it was a good question. And what I understood by what you were telling me when we were screening was essentially, you know, in a polarized environment that we live in today, where people are forced to pick and choose between parties, what was your question surrounding that?
Basically, my question in a nutshell is, with everything that you guys are saying on how we have to build from a foundation, which is community, how do we springboard that into the educational arena, the political arena, the religious arena, to where we're all operating not exactly the same. However, we have ideals or we have goals that are very similar that we're all trying to achieve.
Great question.
Because basically we're all trying to achieve the same thing. We want to live fruitfully, multiply, just like the Bible says, you know, be fruitful and multiply. That's all we want to do. However, now we got this huge gap and this wealth disparity gap we got going on in the world, where you got people who are making billions of dollars, and then on the other end of that spectrum, you got people who are starving, which shouldn't even be happening. Okay, they got to spend, the earth is 75% water, and we have to buy water, and you have to pay a water bill. Who came up with that?
Yeah, so that those are great questions, and thank you for that. And Mike, why don't you take that and.
Sure.
Are you willing to take that off the air? Thanks very much. We're just short on time.
Okay.
Yeah,
thank you.
I just
great
want to
question.
Thank you,
Patrick, for the good of them, for the good of everybody on this call, and for you especially. I'm going to mention a phrase called activating the common good that we have not necessarily tried yet. That I believe is a big. We believe in our school statesmanship is a big part of how we move forward. And it's not minimizing or eliminating the institutions as much as repurposing them, but that there is a role to play for the common good that's in our midst. And we can define common good in different ways, but in essence, it's talking about the people who don't necessarily have positions of power or influence or in officially sanctioned positions or anything like that, but that live in our neighborhoods, live in our communities. How can you activate the good that's going on in our communities in a way where it has more of a role in what gets done and how it gets done versus the deferment and delegation to those who do have officially sanctioned power? And in essence, I'm coming at this because this is what we did in our world of policing in Longmont, was we came at it not from the perspective of, you know, you'll be better because we know better. We came at it from the perspective of, you know, we're the experts, we're the service providers. We will tell you how you can keep yourself safe versus you trying to figure that out for yourself. We really began to share a lot of the responsibility and the power for how to create safety in a community or in a neighborhood. And so there's a book now that I'm going to recommend. It's called Activating the Common Good, written by a friend of mine and one of my mentors named Peter Block, B-L-O-C-K. Highly recommend it. But he's written some other materials, too, that you may want to look under his name, that we utilize quite a bit in our school of statesmanship. And so he and I have been friends. There's another guy named John McKnight, M-C-K-N-I-G-H-T, that also has written some great books on how to move from being a consumer to a citizen. And in terms of that meaning that, you know, are we going, what are we interested in? What others have in mind for us in terms of what happens to us, or are we interested in producing our own creation and our own future? And so up until now, we've had this dependency on wherever that consumer model might be. It's not just applies to shopping. It applies to services. It applies to what we do with our children. It applies to so many different things in our lives. Is how to move from consumer to citizen, and so now to kind of take charge of your life in a way where you're not subject to what others have in mind for you versus your own being a producer of your own future. So that's what I'll say to you now, Patrick, in terms of, and others on the line, is what this is about is activating the common good in a way that it's never been activated before, so that there is a sense of being kind of having some authorship for our own experiences and our own destiny versus that being kind of dictated to us by others. And so there are ways of doing that. And we have models that we can point to where that's happened and worked. But on the other hand, I know Carol wants to say something.
Yeah, I know we're going to run out of time. And Patrick, Mike's email is Mike Butler, B-U-T-L-E-R, all one word, at sosis.org. And email him, and you will start a wonderful relationship that you will appreciate.
Or anybody else on this phone
That's
call.
Right.
You
oh, wow, what a generous offer. That's S-O-S-S-A-S. Sosis.
S-O-S-S-A-S.
Mike Butler at sosis.org.
And please sign up for our newsletter, because in the summer, we are going to, we will be into that next 15-class module on service, and we are heading into democracy.
Wow.
Now, that's a big topic, especially this year, right? And we're going to hold those classes at the Innovation Center, but we're going to be in a very expanded space. And we're also going to, we will by then, by summer, we will have WebEx connections. And John McKnight is going to Zoom in for that. Now, John McKnight is 93 years old, and he started in Chicago with neighborhood.
Buddies with Saul Alinsky and Robert.
Neighborhood
Temple.
Organization. And if you track back to the understanding of how you make a difference one block at a time. He now, he's taught at Northwestern. He's traveled around the world as an ambassador. He has so much goodness. And he works with ABCD organization, Asset-Based Community Development. He's excited about what we're doing. And we're going to head into this this concept around democracy, how we all it's not just about a vote. It's not just about an elected official. It's about our accountability, our showing up, our making something happen that we want to happen, our making a difference in the world. We're working on the neighborhood idea. How do you bring the neighborhood? How do you find all the social capital that's right around you? It's not about the economic capital anymore. That's an outdated model too. There is abundance and richness everywhere.
Wow.
And we just have to activate, as Mike says, we have to activate this goodness. We have to activate each other. We have to move into living faith. I'm going to pull up one thing I read this morning in the papers. My iPad doesn't want to work.
So let's just talk a little bit about the Carol talked about the newsletter. If you go on sosis.org, you can sign up for the newsletter. You have my email address.
Mine's easier. It's just carol@sosis.org. You're welcome to email me, too.
Sure. It's Carol with a C.
Carol with a C. This is from 100, section 3, paragraph 7. Man cannot cause growth, but he can supply favorable conditions. Growth is always unconscious, be it physical, intellectual, or spiritual. Love thus grows. It cannot be created, manufactured, or purchased. It must grow. Evolution is a cosmic technique of growth. Social growth cannot be secured by legislation And moral growth is not had by improved administration. Man may manufacture a machine, but its real value must be derived from human culture and personal appreciation. Man's sole contribution to growth is the mobilization of the total powers of his personality. Living faith.
Living faith.
Yeah, beautiful.
So amazing.
The other thing that I always want to give, you know, it's almost like we talk about these things in ways that only man can be the answer to but there is, I'm absolutely convinced that our various levels of our celestial community, from the most highs to our secondary midwares, have a lot of influence on what's happening. And so we always have to kind of remember that in terms of of the gifts of that, of those branches, spiritual, celestial aid aspects in our planet's existence. And so something to be always thinking about. And so how many times have we read that, you know, man likes to think they're in charge, but the Most Highs really have a lot to say about what's going on. So I'm making a bet there too. So.
We can make their job easier if we just cooperate. with the master plan, the master's plan.
Mm-hmm.
And what a wonderful treat to have you guys on. Andre, did you have something you wanted to say?
Just pointing out we're in our last 2.5 minutes.
Yeah.
So anything you want to sum up with you guys on the school of statesmanship and stewardship and service and stewardship?
You know, get in touch with us if this interests you. We would love to have more Your Rancher Book readers associated with this. You know, we on our project team, Carol and I are those that read the Your Rancher papers, and I think the rest of the group wonders what the heck are they talking about sometimes. But on the other hand, we would love to have more people to help us, maybe participate in some of the courses as they're coming down the pike. Go again, sosis.org. You can find the dates of those courses. Any contribution someone wants to make, we're open to that. We did get a fairly large grant and to help us with that police project that we talked about, so we're good.
Fantastic.
There. But on the other hand, we're just getting started, humble beginnings, and we're still humble. But we both have an unassailable conviction when it comes to moving forward with our school of statesmanship, stewardship, and service.
Right. You can also find us. You know, we are social media. We understand. I come from the world of design and merchandising. I understand this outreach of. So you can share that with your friends and family. If you are on Instagram, where it's sosis_org, and that will get you
Facebook, right?
And Facebook.
Yeah.
So that will get you to more news and some of the clips. We are working on a virtual learning platform. We hope to have that available by the fall, where you can take the classes online and then have
great.
We talk a lot about this interactive learning and how important it is that we have person to person as we go through some of the exercises. So we're figuring all that out. And
well,
it's a, design in process. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so
Paula
much.
And
you are
Pam
inspiring.
And
I want to sign
and
up.
Andre. Sure. Thank you for the opportunity.
Absolutely.
And we'd like to come on maybe in a year from now or so and say, here's the progress that's going on.
Yay.
So.
Oh, please.
Absolutely.
We'd love to hear you.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, we so appreciate you, and we're officially just went off, but we got the last word, and I think people understand where to go.
This will be on the archive. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Mm-hmm. And we'll have lots of listeners on the archive. We had a great group on the board, and thank you so much for coming. Wonderful to interview you. You've totally inspired me.
Yeah. Great conversation. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
very good.
Yeah, great to hear about this.
Yeah, I'm speechless, yeah. We'll be back next week, friends. Thanks to Mike and Carol. Thank you very much again, and we'll see you next week on The Cosmic Citizen.
Thanks.
Much love to you all.
Bye for now. Thank you.
Love you all.
Bye for now.
Have a great
week. Love you.
Love you too.
Have a great week.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.